Hey team, welcome back to the show. Today it is Coach Andrea and I with part three of the female body recomposition blueprint. Today we're really going to be digging into how to optimize your nutrition for body recomp. So as a refresher, part one, we kind of talked about the basics of body recomposition, what's possible for the different types. Part two, we talked about foundational principles for a healthy, responsive body, basically how to get your hormones, your thyroid, things of that nature in a good place. And here again, we're going to be taking a deep dive into nutrition, really how to set your nutrition up for the most optimal results in a body recomposition phase. So before we get into it, Andrea, anything you want to throw in there?
Yeah, I mean, like we talked about in the very first one, anytime you're, or even in previous podcasts outside of this series with nutrition, whenever we're looking at fat loss, that kind of plays the primary role in training is the support. When we're looking at building, nutrition is kind of the support, building is the training is the primary role. And really in recomp, depending on the type of recomp that you're going after, it can be either one or just sort of like really a pretty heavy focus on both. And so nutrition plays a really big role here, and I think this is going to be a helpful episode.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we get into this, like we talked about, there are going to be three different types of body recomposition. There is going to be losing fat and building muscle at the same time. There will be, hey, we just maintain, but we build a considerable amount of muscle. Or maybe you're someone who builds a little bit of muscle and primarily it's just like going through a fat loss phase, which again would be like the rarest type for like much more advanced type person who already has a lot of muscle. But here we're primarily going to be focusing on that primary, like what people primarily think of, where it's we're losing a pretty considerable amount of fat, but we're also building muscle at the same time. And that is such an important point, right? Where it's like, if you want to achieve this, you do have to have both of these factors pretty dialed in. So I would say like it's harder to do if you're lackadaisical with either your training or nutrition.
Yeah, sure.
So let's go ahead and get into first, how do we determine with this type of body recomposition what rate of loss we should be seeing, like how much weight we should be losing per week?
Yeah, so for that person who is looking basically to do both at the same time, the fat loss isn't a whole lot different as far as your goal for rate of loss than a typical fat loss phase. So typical fat loss phase, we're most of the time looking for somewhere between half and 1% per week, losing body fat. With body recomp, we can get on the more aggressive side, and see more consistent fat loss. Or if you are someone that maybe you have not as much body fat to lose, and we're also really looking to keep your training a big priority as far as the energy coming in to focus on quality of training, then we can get on the less aggressive side closer to a 0.5% per week. So if we're looking at someone that is 150 pounds, a pound and a half, that's going to be 3/4 of a pound to 1.5 pound per week on that range. So if you're looking at someone that is looking for 1.5 pounds of fat loss per week, that would need to be a 5,250 calorie weekly deficit. And so that comes out to 750 calories per day, which is a pretty big chunk. And so you want to make sure that you're starting out in a good position, because if you are not starting from a very high calorie intake, then pulling 750 calories is going to be basically impossible to stick to. So, for example, if somebody is eating 2,200 calories per day to maintain, which is pretty reasonable for 150 pound person, that puts you at 1,450 calories per day. So fairly aggressive in order to see on the top end of that. And then if you don't want to get quite as aggressive, you could and stay more towards that 0.5% per week, that would be like 350 to 400 calorie per day deficit, which puts you at a slower rate of loss, but also you're taking in, what would that be? What did I say? 2,200. So you would be at like 1,750 calories per day, which is a significantly more amount of food in order to focus on training really hard, putting more of those carbs around your training, you're going to feel quite a bit different than if you're on 1450.
Yeah. I fully agree with that. And I also think that like the where you're coming from, again, is so important here. I just feel like we can't emphasize this enough because so many people who shouldn't be trying this type of body recomposition, where it's like, we should probably be at maintenance and just like focusing on fueling you while you're always so lean. This is what they want. Now, on the flip side, I also think when we're talking about getting more aggressive versus being a little bit less aggressive, honestly, someone who like has never built much muscle and is like kind of brand new to the training stimulus, anecdotally, I don't really see like us being more aggressive with the diet really slowing down the rate of muscle gain much at all. Do you?
No. Yeah, that's
now that's again different for if you've been training well for a decent amount of time, you've already built a decent amount of muscle. That's a completely different story. But like for that person who's brand new, I think it more so depends on your ability to adhere. But that's like the biggest problem, I think, is a lot of times people like think, oh, yeah, I want to like do it as quickly as possible. And then it's like the, I'm not able to be consistent with it. So I think kind of like knowing yourself and meeting the client where they're at, what would you say like within that like rate of loss, what do you say is probably going to be the most common that you're going to aim for with a client?
Honestly, somewhere in between, like a pound per week for this type of person is a pretty good rate of loss. Really, with this type of person, like you said, somebody newer to training, or newer to training properly, at least with hypertrophy focus, I'm not going to have them do much different than if they were just purely in a fat loss phase.
Yeah.
And then just by the fact that we are going to be dialing in their training and their peri-workout nutrition and micros and all that, they're going to see the other side of things improve too. So it's just sort of more like a byproduct than it is actually changing what we're doing.
No, I like that. I think that like people kind of get this misunderstood where you coach it exactly like you would a fat loss phase. It's just, as you said, like for this type, just the recomp will happen as a byproduct of that. But again, it's, you just have to make sure we're dialed in on all these variables. So talk us through like macros. Okay. So again, like kind of this determining our rate of loss, the rate of loss we're aiming for is the first piece. And also important to understand that you won't see yourself linearly. You won't always see like we're losing exactly X amount. So exactly 0.75% of body weight per week. Right? So we're looking at averages across several weeks. But then from there, again, that's kind of our starting point with, okay, this determines about what our calorie intake should be, or at least what we estimate it should be to start. From there, how are we setting macros? What does that look like?
Yeah, just to touch on that real quick first before getting into macros too, I think it people can take it way too far with like, well, I didn't lose any weight this month, but I've probably just built muscle because I'm training. And that's where like we want to look at measurements, pictures, and the scale. For almost everybody am wanting to see the scale go down if we're wanting fat loss, even if we're building muscle.
I agree.
So there are cases where I'm like, hey, yeah, we didn't see really a ton of shift on the scale, but also look at the giant change in measurements that we saw, or your pictures are visibly different. Then there are special cases like that, but almost always it's not like we're building so much muscle that it's completely counteracting the fat loss. Yeah. Like we really actually need to see the scale going down to know
that's
that there's
a great
fat loss.
Point for this person, for again, the person who's a good candidate for this specifically, where we can lose a good amount of fat and build muscle. I've had that conversation several times with clients, even like in the last couple of weeks, where it's like, hey, the scale hasn't moved, but I've been building a lot of muscle. And I don't like say this like in a, of course, like want to approach this tactfully, but it, like, I appreciate where we're at there and we are getting stronger, but this, we're actually like not losing fat this week because this thing that we talked through, like these three things we talked through happened. We're not like you built a pound of muscle this week and that's why we didn't see the scale drop. And I think like just being realistic there. Whereas again, like that person who's that recomposition at maintenance, right? Where it's, hey, we're building muscle. We're not necessarily losing fat. That's where we might see, yes, the scale isn't changing, but your body shape is changing, right? Mm-hmm. But and again, there will be instances where like progress pictures or body measurements shift and weight didn't, and maybe we're okay with that for a week, but just generally we should see the scale dropping. Okay, so dig into macros for us. How do we set those up?
So typically the go-to for setting up macros first is going to be protein at about a gram per pound of body weight. And that is very general, and that mm-hmm. can shift one way or the other depending on somebody's total body mass, or if they're more obese and their lean body mass is going to be quite a bit different than their total body mass. But a good general rule of thumb is still going to be 1 gram per pound, because that is going to be enough higher than the actual like minimum that you need to see to build muscle that yeah. you're good. Like, you don't have to worry about trace proteins and things like that, because you have a good safety net there. But it's not so high that it starts to mess with digestion or anything like that for most people. So
I also think with the protein, like, I'm sorry for interrupting, but like, you could for sure argue that higher intake is more optimal. But again, it's kind of like the word optimal, where does optimal mean practical? And typically a person who's a good candidate for this type of recomp, if it was like, hey, you weigh 150 pounds and we're going to have you eating like, let's say 1.5 times body weight, so like 225 grams of protein, in theory, that's great. And I think you and I probably both eat like, I have 300 grams of protein a day. And I'm
like, really?
Yeah. I'm not sure. Maybe yours isn't actually that high, but
no, mine's about a gram per pound, actually.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, anyways, we could argue that like that might be like slightly more optimal, but also like in reality, in application for, again, this type of person is typically someone where honestly, that person was probably eating like 40 to 60 grams a day before they started mm-hmm. to where it's again, like this is like kind of almost like, hey, we're really stretching it. We're doing something uncomfortable where we can do this. But I think it's again kind of like past that, it can start to be less practical for the individual. So I just said an important note there. But I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, that's fine. I really think that for beyond just the practicality point of it, digestion starts to be the thing that is the rate limiter on protein. You have to at some point break it out into more meals than what some people, and that comes back to practicality too. Like, if you're eating 7 meals per day, like there's not really time in the day for that for most people. But then if you combine a lot of protein into fewer meals, then it starts to become harder to digest. So a gram per pound tends to be a pretty good starting point. And then from there, based on people's digestion, how they're feeling, what their comfortability is with moving that up, I might go up or down based on the person.
Okay.
And then after that, we'll look at fats. So you want to make sure that you have enough fats for staying healthy. So fats are important for hormone health, hair, skin, nails, even like heart health and things like that. Some types of fat are going to be important. And so we want to make sure that we're then prioritizing getting enough of those in. And so usually that's going to be about a 0.3 to 0.4 grams per pound. So we can go a little bit higher than that for some people. We can go a little bit lower than that for shorter periods of time through a fat loss phase. But usually we want to stick around that area when we're in a maintenance to even like most of the deficit, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then beyond that, carbs are going to fill out the rest, because carbs are going to be your fuel source for training. They're going to store in the muscle as glycogen, and they're also most of the time your micronutrient dense foods. So mm-hmm. fruits and veggies, where you get most of your micronutrients, those are carbohydrate foods. So that's just helpful to, if you have more carbohydrates in your day, you're way more likely to be able to cover your micronutrient bases too. But for the purposes of like looking at body recomposition, carbs are what you need in order to train as hard as you can. And if you're training as hard as you can, then you're going to see more progress in building muscle as you diet down.
Absolutely. I don't think I have anything to add there. I think the macros are pretty explanatory. We've covered yeah. quite a bit. So from here, then the peri-workout nutrition, really how we are fueling ourselves to, again, train hard, recover well. We talk about this quite a bit as well, but it is such an important aspect of this and something that so many people leave on the table. Talk us through. What are we looking at here with peri-workout nutrition?
Yeah. So the purpose of your peri-workout nutrition first with pre-workout is going to be make sure that you're going into your training session well-fueled, topping off glycogen stores, have quick energy available. And again, that's just setting you up for the best possible training session. We want to make sure that we're eating in order to maximize performance, because right. If you maximize your performance, then you get a better stimulus, you get better muscle growth throughout this phase. And so I'll get into details about pre-workout and everything, but then the post-workout meal, afterwards, you're also, refilling glycogen stores, refueling with carbohydrates, repairing with protein, fats. Post-workout, you can have more fat than you have pre-workout, but it's not something that I really like actively chase post-workout. Yeah. And then away from your training session through the rest of the day, you have your other meals where those are going to be more like protein, plants, any carbs that you have left over, and then the majority of your fats. Okay. So pre and post-workout, we're looking to have an even split of protein. So if let's say you have four meals across the day, each of your meals should have about 25% of your daily protein. That way you're getting pretty even pulses of amino acids throughout the day. That way you're maximizing muscle protein synthesis. You're making sure that you digest and absorb it well. And you're not having like one much larger meal where more isn't always better, and then one much smaller meal where you don't get enough of your amino acids. So if you spread it pretty evenly, then that covers all those bases. Then you also want anywhere from like a third to two thirds of your daily carbs split between your pre and post workout. That's a really big range, but it depends on how many carbs you have available and what phase you're in. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, I think that's super accurate. And I mean, also, if you are like in a maintenance phase or a building phase, you might actually have like carbs intra-workout as well. Mm-hmm. But I think that, yeah, like when we're in a fat loss phase and you don't have that many carbs to work with, it might be closer to like two thirds of your daily carbs, as you said. Whereas if your carbs are pretty high in like a maintenance phase or a building phase, it might actually be like, hey, we're just pushing to get like 50% here, and that's still plenty. But I think that's, mm-hmm. yeah, that's super accurate.
Yeah, I would say looking at, If you get at least 30 carbs pre-workout and post-workout, even if you're on pretty minimal carbs through the day, that's going to be a solid number to give you some fuel going into your training session. So that, like I said, if you're in the depths of a fat loss phase and your total carbs are 100 for the day, then that's going to be two thirds of your daily carbs between the pre and post. So 60. And then if that, as that goes up, as your total daily carbs for the day go up, that's still like a smaller percentage, if that makes sense. Right. So you've got your carbs and your protein pre-workout and post-workout. We also want to make sure that you get plenty of water and sodium. So if you are just drinking a bunch of water, but you don't have the sodium, then you're not actually going to be absorbing that water into like your muscle cells for training, for example. Later in the day, that's also still important, even though you're away from your training session, because it actually helps with digestion as well. It helps pull water into your muscle cells. It also helps pull water into your digestive tract. So it helps with digestion. And that sodium also, because it's pulling water into the muscle cell, is going to help with the pump during your training session. Now we've got the components of your pre and post workout are going to be protein, carbs, hydration, and sodium. And then pre-workout to post-workout timing, that's going to vary depending on the amount of food that you're eating, how far away from your training session it's practical for you to eat. So if you're going to be eating 2 to 3 hours pre-workout, you can probably stand to have a little bit of fat in there. Let's say like 3 to 9 grams of fat. That seems like super specific numbers, but somewhere within there that it's not so high that it's going to slow down your digestion quite a bit. If you're eating, like if you're somebody that gets up and immediately heads to the gym, then you're going to be eating somewhere within like 15 to 30 minutes pre-workout. You can go zero fat with like rice cakes, honey, a whey protein shake, or even Gatorade, a protein shake, EAAs, that sort of thing, so that you're digesting it pretty instantly. And then as far as post-workout timing, that doesn't matter quite as much, but you want to make sure that you're not going more than 4 or 5 hours after your pre-workout meal. So if you're eating your pre-workout meal at 6, you go train at 8, you want to make sure that you get that next workout in, or next meal in by 10 or 11 post-workout. So you don't have to immediately leave and drink a protein shake to make sure that you're like within the anabolic window, but you don't want to go too far from that pre-workout meal. Okay. So that you're getting another dose of amino acids.
If we were, what are the instances where you might add like an intra-workout drink, and what would that typically look like?
So in theory, during a fat loss phase would almost be the best time to have an intra-workout drink, because you're overall low on fuel and that's going to help you the most.
Your glycogen stores, the biggest difference in your training.
Exactly. Probably. Yeah. Yeah. Your glycogen stores aren't always full. And so during training, while you're dieting, you're going to notice the most improvement in your performance from it then. But then we also have to look at, if you're taking 20 grams of carbs away to put during training as liquid, that takes away 20 grams of carbs that you could have as salad or potato later on when you're really hungry in a deficit. So for most people, I'm not really adding that until we're at maintenance, just for adherence sake.
Yeah.
So if you are at in maintenance or in a build, then that's where I'll typically put in some intra-workout carbs. And that can range really wildly. And how I determine that is, we're going to start out at like 15 or 20 grams on the lower side. And if somebody is at the point where they're eating so much food that they have a hard time getting it in through the day, we can titrate that up just to fill out the rest of their carbs, because it is going to be something that's really easy to get in because it's liquid. You don't have to have like stomach capacity for that.
Right.
And so that can be either Gatorade or highly branched cyclic dextrin. Those are typically the two top choices. There is a little bit of a benefit of highly branched cyclic dextrin, just because it's going to digest just a little bit easier, but it's also like 5 times the cost or something like that.
I think it's honestly more than that.
Yeah. And you have to order it. Whereas Gatorade powder is like at Walmart, and you can just put like gram for gram, like I'm sure highly branched cyclic dextrin is the same, but gram for gram, it's like you need 10 grams of carbs. You put in 10 grams of powder. It's really easily accessible. It's cheap. Like that's typically what I recommend. It's honestly like, I know that we're always going after those little 1% things, but this is like not even a 1% thing between Gatorade and highly branched cyclic dextrin. So I'll typically just recommend Gatorade. And then you want to make sure that you're diluting it in enough water that it doesn't cause any digestive upset. So what I will usually do and recommend is one shaker of your Gatorade, one shaker of just water, and drink on both of those so that it dilates it. Or if you want to carry around a gallon jug in the gym, that's fine too. Depends on how much Gatorade you have to use. But just make sure that it's really light tasting. If it's pretty strong tasting, that's probably a sign that it is going to sit a little heavier in your stomach, and you might have to run to the bathroom during your training session. So along with that, you also want sodium. So I'll usually recommend 1/4 teaspoon of salt along with it, just mixed in, 1/8 teaspoon of potassium, which for most people, I will recommend that. If somebody is like, I want to do the least amount possible here, then that's something that I won't worry about. And then EAAs are also helpful intra workout, just to provide some more amino acids during your training.
Okay. I love it. I think we really nailed that. So moving on to micronutrients, talk us through this. I know we already kind of touched on why these are important in the last episode, but really, again, like these are going to be so crucial for having the healthiest, most responsive body. Let's get into micronutrients. Talk us through that.
Yeah. So like we talked about last week, in order to make the best progress, You want to make sure that you are as healthy as possible. And if we're getting in our micronutrients, it's going to make sure that you are recovering adequately, your thyroid is functioning properly, your sex hormones are in a good place. And just the healthier you are, the better you feel, the more energy you have, the better you're going to be able to train. So in order to make sure that you are hitting your micros, there's a few different ways that you can go about this. So first would be plug all your foods into Chronometer and make sure that it ticks all the boxes. Chronometer is a free app. It's a little bit more, I would say a little bit worse of a user interface than MyFitnessPal, but it's not hard to use. You can just plug all your foods in there. And even if you tend to use a different food app, you can use it one or two times, plug your foods in there if you're covering all of your micronutrient bases. Another thing that you can do is use the Vertical Diet Principles, which has a checklist of different foods that you can eat to make sure that you're getting all your micros. So the checklist for Vertical Diet is use iodized sea salt on at least two or three meals. Berries or oranges, two or more servings per day. Two or more cups of spinach per day. One to two servings of another veggie of choice per day. 6 to 8 baby carrots daily, at least one egg yolk, 30 grams or more of carbs from potato, 10 almonds, one or more servings of dairy, ideally Greek yogurt, a vitamin D supplement, 3 to 5,000 IUs per day, and one serving per day of red meat, and then fatty fish two or more times weekly, or an omega-3 supplement. So if you hit that checklist per day, that's going to be, I haven't actually totaled up the calories for this, but I would say it's probably like 600 to 800 calories with hitting all of those things.
Right.
Yeah. And so that, it sounds like, oh my gosh, I would just be eating only these things and I would be really restricted. But in total, if it's 600 to 800 calories of your daily total, then you have quite a bit of extra room there to put in your typical like foods that you enjoy. And that's going to cover your micronutrients.
It sounds like more, I think like when you list it out, it sounds like more than it actually is when you put it in an application. And honestly, it's such an easy way to really like tick almost all the boxes with your micros without like having to think about it too much. And it kind of just like a skeleton where you have a ton of flexibility still in your diet outside of that if you want it.
Yeah. I mean, whenever we put together meal plans for people, we can knock out 3 or 4 of these within one meal. So like Greek yogurt, almonds, berries, and baby carrots on the side, that's a really good meal. And that covers, I think I said 4 of those.
Yeah.
So
then if you have like an egg scramble with spinach, you of course have your egg yolk in there and then some egg whites. And then we like mix that with some potatoes. Mm-hmm. And then maybe you have like baby carrots and berries alongside that. We've covered like everything from those two meals basically, except for the red meat, I guess, or the omega-3, or except for the red meat, which I will say that's probably the one that is a lot more like, I have a lot of clients who are just like, I don't like red meat for whatever reason. And that's where, did you already mention a multivitamin?
No.
Okay. Where a lot of times like a multivitamin as like kind of an insurance policy to cover, make sure we take those boxes would be a good call, but sorry, go on.
So plug into Chronometer, use the Vertical Diet Principles, and then just a very like bare bones, very low hanging fruit way that I'll get people to cover a lot of bases, even though it's probably not going to be all of them, is let's make sure and get a couple servings of fruits and vegetables at each of your meals and occasionally eat some red meat and salmon. And then alongside that, like you said, a micronutrient, or a multivitamin is going to fill any gaps there. And that's also, if you're doing all these things, you're also going to be getting plenty of fiber. Digestion should be pretty good. And so it really covers a lot of bases.
Okay. I love it. I think that's a great summary of the micronutrient side of things. So finally, let's wrap this up talking about, when would you implement things like calorie cycling, diet breaks, maybe like different training day and rest day targets? How would we implement those? Like, when would we be looking to implement those things?
Yeah. So with calorie cycling, that can be done really like any number of ways based on just the person's preference or what they need at that time. So you could do 1 or 2 high days with 5 or 6 low days. You can do training day high training days and low rest days. I will use this differently depending on the person. So if it's somebody that is more advanced, then I'm probably going more training days and rest days, macros. But people tend to train on the weekdays and rest on the weekends. So if it's someone that's not quite as into this and or on just much lower calories, then having the low days on the weekends can kind of be difficult adherence wise, because that's when you want to go out to eat more. And so in that case, maybe we'll do one or two high days and pair those up with the weekend and have five or six low days through the weekdays. The downside of doing it that way is you're pairing your lower calorie intake with your training days where you need more energy. And people tend to be sometimes more sedentary on the weekends. And so there's pluses and minuses of having that higher intake when you're resting. Like, it can be great for just, I'm completely resting on these days. Like, I'm resting from the deficit. I'm also resting from training. And that can have its upsides with going into the next days more well-fueled and rested. But ideally, I'm going to put higher intake on training days and lower intake on rest days. And there's, again, this is kind of like one of those 1% things, but when you have higher intake on training days, lower intake on rest days, what happens is you get more carbohydrates in your diet when you can use them and when you are more insulin sensitive, because anytime you train afterward, you're going to be more insulin sensitive. So you're going to take those carbs in and utilize them to be stored as glycogen better than if you were to be resting. Then on your rest days, you have a lower carb intake. And so you could potentially get a little bit more of a like metabolic flexibility improvement there because you're going a little bit lower carb. So on average for the week, if you just work that out to be the same daily, you might have like, you might not get those same benefits, even though technically your weekly average is the same.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. I think there's two ways I'll typically approach this. Be it like higher carb, and as a result, higher calorie days on training days, lower calorie days on rest days. And then like when I'm starting to see like hunger is creeping up a little bit, maybe adherence is a little bit of a struggle or rate of loss is slowing a little bit, then I'll add in a refeed day at maintenance. And that kind of replaces one of the training day high days and like keep those three lower days. And then we might go eventually to two of those days. Or we can just do a linear, like we're at the same intake. And then once we start to see pretty good rate of loss over a couple of weeks, then we will introduce like a refeed day and then maybe two refeed days as we start to see needed. Again, at maintenance, typically, I'll say the first approach though is typically like as of now, what I use a little bit more frequently. It sounds a little bit more complex, but honestly, I think people feel very good on it. It's not as hard to follow as you would think. And I do see like a quicker rate of loss typically with that as well.
Yeah, that's a good point too, actually, with switching it, because I framed it as like the more advanced person, this is how I'll start them. But a lot of times too, I might start them that way. And then when rate of loss slows, then we switch over to those 2 days higher on the weekend. So now we're cutting in half the number of high days we have and our overall calorie deficit is larger.
Yeah, absolutely. What about diet breaks?
So diet breaks are something that are primarily like an adherence tool. So they do have some benefits temporarily of like boosting leptin and reducing your hunger, improving performance, filling out your glycogen stores. But that's not something that's going to be long lasting once you get back into the deficit. So it's primarily going to be just a break mentally from the deficit, mentally and physically from the deficit. So you're bringing your calories back up to maintenance for really anywhere from a week to really 4 to 6 weeks could be a diet break. It's really an as needed basis. So I like to frame these as practicing for maintenance long term, because a lot of people are very focused on the deficit. And this is like the primary reason why I'm paying attention to my nutrition is because right. I want to lose body fat. But losing the body fat doesn't matter if we gain it back afterward. So if we can take these intermittent weeks to months in the middle of the fat loss phase, we can use that to practice maintenance while primarily keeping our foods very similar, but just more of them. So it allows you to, while you're still in fat loss mode, bring your food up, but not go off the rails with like, now that I have more freedom, I'm going to include all of these different higher palatability foods. So I really like framing them that way because the break, the using a diet break, I think sometimes people can be like, oh, this is just sort of like wasted time. Or even though it right. is a mental break, it's not like productive. But when we think about it as this is going to help us long term keep the result that I'm working so hard for, then it feels more purposeful. And it really is like something that is important to practice so that we can then into the fat loss phase later on and know like, okay, if I just increase the amount of my food here versus completely change my foods, I'm going to feel so much better, but I'm also going to maintain this fat loss that I've been working at for the last however many weeks.
Absolutely. And I think that it's not like we have to take diet breaks. I've had some clients where, hey, we're just cruising. We're just cruising. Like my client, Josh Wheeler, is someone who comes to mind. I think he lost like 60 pounds last year and we didn't take a diet break once because he was just good, man. I feel great. I'm pushing. We're making great progress. But for most people, what we'll see is about 12 to 16 weeks in, adherence does start to slip a little bit more. And that's where it's like, if we just keep trying to push and grind along, we're not going to get anywhere. Whereas like taking a little bit of time to almost get a mental reset, eating more food, we're just more motivated, more adherent, going back to the diet, and we do see better progress. And it is almost kind of like studying for the test, so to speak, right? Where I think people think like fat loss is the test, but really like maintaining the result is the test. And again, it's kind of like time studying that. So really like that framing of practicing maintenance is super valuable. And it almost always also ends up aligning with like, hey, I'm going on this trip, or I have this thing, this event, where it just makes sense for us to probably not try to diet during that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so much more mentally frustrating if you're going into like a vacation or the holidays thinking, I'm going to still continue to make progress. Where if we just frame this as, hey, if we don't change any at all in on the scale over the next however long, then that's a big win. That's exactly what we're looking for. Same result,
feel successful but, afterwards. Yeah,
same result, but you feel mentally so much better.
Yeah, because most people otherwise go into that time and it's like, if we go into that with the goal was fat loss and I didn't lose any fat, it feels like failure, which is mm-hmm. very common. But if it's again like, hey, the goal was to do just good enough to maintain, you do that, great, we nailed it. So yeah, I really like that for me as well. Anything else you want to add before we wrap this episode up?
I don't think so.
Okay, cool. Well, I think this was a very good summary of kind of the basics of nutrition when it comes to optimizing body recomposition. Next week, we're going to dig into training, which I'm excited for. But for now, that is all we have for y'all. If you want to apply to work with our team, get your own body recomposition started, just click the link in the show notes, and we will catch you guys next time.